late 1960s, a lot of young people started thinking about moving to the country. Many were city kids who had started traveling around the country in old vans and school buses. In these circles of traveling hippies, stories spread about the communes in the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. For some, going back to the land was a way to escape from the conflicts and contradictions of city living. Others saw country living as an opportunity to live out their political ideals. At first, the Back to the Land movement was a male-dominated scene, but by the early 1970s, many lesbian feminists were also moving to the country. Some women moved up from the city. Others, like Estrella, were already living on rural communes.
I was a hippie before I was a lesbian, and when I was a hippie on land, I had this fantasy that we would all kick the guys off and the women would stay. This actually did happen on some pieces of land that became women's land. However, on the land that I was on, it did not happen. So I decided to leave and go to Berkeley and become a dyke. When I was there, I wasn't getting along very well because the dykes in Berkeley went to bars, and I had been a hippie for so long and was used to living on land and eating brown rice and tofu. So I came up here to Mendocino and joined a commune of women who, like myself, wanted to be separatists, wanted to live as women on land together in the country with other women and create a whole new women's culture.
I'm walking this road, the great spirit is with me, it's a circling road. Oh, I'm walking this road, the great spirit is with me, it's a circling road.
I came from New York City to California in 1969, and I moved to Black Bear, a commune in Northern California. Very rugged, very isolated, without electricity. I was only there a year and a half, but I had my daughter there.
Fan Shen is an old friend of Estrella's.
I came to live here in Albion, connected with the women who were living in Casper, which is two towns up. They called themselves Casper Aurora. They were renting a place that had a whole bunch of little structures. They were all women who were all coming out, and they were very fierce lesbians, even though most of them hadn't been with a woman yet.
Oh, I'm walking this road, the Mother Earth is with me, it's a circling road. Oh, I'm walking this road, the Mother Earth is with me, it's a circling road.
The woman I was involved with ran off with somebody else, and I was heartbroken, and one of my friends took me down to some land in southern Oregon that belonged to friends of hers.
Space Dolphin moved from Chicago to Portland, Oregon in 1970.
And being there really helped me get over the heartbreak, and it just felt so good to be out in nature. And I started thinking, oh, it would be nice to have women's land, because I liked being there, but I didn't feel totally comfortable because men lived there. There were no women living on land, just women. Well, there was like these two women, both of whom were straight at the time, that had this mining claim.
I lived 7 miles up a dirt road. I lived in a squat. It was a mining claim. It was a one-room cabin. It had a barrel stove in it. And I'd heard about where it was, and I went up the road and found it and moved in. I had to rebuild the floor. I had to put a new roof on it. By most people's standards, would have been a shack. I thought it was great. I didn't have to pay any rent there, and I just sort of lived there.
Like, I was really inspired to meet women like Sierra who lived in those places and knew things about chopping wood and growing gardens.
Oh, oh, I'm walking this road and the sun is with me, it's a circling road. Oh, oh, I'm walking this road and the sun is with me, it's a circling road.
I was a recently divorced woman with two teenage children. And I wanted to live in the country, and I didn't want to live alone with my kids.
Jean Mattengrove moved to Southern Oregon in the fall of 1970.
I spent that first winter feeling pretty isolated and alone, as I was the only middle-aged woman with children and with all these 20-year-olds around me. The next summer, Ruth came out. We became lovers, and she decided to come back and stay with me. And when she came back in October, bringing her daughter and 40 boxes of books, we didn't know any other lesbians. And we set out to find them. We went to Eugene and Portland, and we met a group of young lesbians whom we invited to come visit us in the country. And they began to do that and pass the word around. And we had a number of women visiting us through the next summer.
six of us got a place outside of Portland. It was a little cabin that we rented and renovated because it had no windows and we had to re-roof it. Remember, we didn't have much money, so we insulated with ferns. Thousands and thousands, millions of ferns.
I had some money and I wanted to buy a piece of land. So I bought this land in Albion, and Jean and I moved here and started a commune.
Carmen Goodyear and her lover Jean were the first lesbians to move to Albion.
There were a lot of other people our age who'd come up from LA and Berkeley and back east, and we started meeting together. Now, at the same time, Jean had a friend who was in Palo Alto at Stanford who had started going to a women's consciousness raising group. She brought us all this material. Jean and I read them and contacted maybe five other what we call homestead wives, women who had moved here with their husbands and young children. We met to have a consciousness raising group. We sat down. Nobody had ever been in one or really knew what it was. There was no structure, no leader. It was the most unusual thing to be in a meeting that nobody was chairing. We all, being women, just started talking. That group lasted about 9 months. We all grew so close that we decided we needed to throw over all the rest of our lives and move in, which of course nobody could really do. So the group kind of fell apart, but within 6 months we'd started another one, which was 17 women. Jean and I were still the only lesbians. Two other women who had some academic literary background and Jean decided they wanted to start a magazine.
There was an editorial collective that was ongoing. For each issue, two or three from the editorial collective would work on that issue with 3 to 6 maybe other women in the community, both straight and lesbian women.
We would set up a kind of a consciousness raising group around a topic and meet once a week and just share ideas and write letters to people outside the area to get more information. The first issue we printed a few hundred, distributed them in this area and the Bay Area and sent them to friends. Even if people didn't have the wherewithal to move to the country, it was a fantasy that everybody was interested in. And so we just started getting subscription orders right away.
I read Country Woman magazine when I was living in New York City. The particular issue was about planting. And there were a group of us in New York City that were doing gardening, putting gardens in old lots that were full of debris and rubble in the city and making compost piles and plastic bags on our fire escapes.
Meadow first came to Albion in the mid-70s.
We were looking for women's land to live on and to live with women rurally and decided to come to California. There was an ad in there about a group of women looking for women to join them to do that, so I came out to this area.
We went to the bookstore, Woman's Place, in Oakland and saw a mimeographed announcement on the bulletin board about women starting a Country Women magazine in Albion, California. So on our way home, we drove up to Albion, and they weren't home, and we camped under a tree. And in the morning, I helped with the chores because they weren't really very glad to see these strangers. But before the morning was over, they were telling us about this magazine, and we agreed to write for them.
There was a very strong core of women who were close with each other and had done a lot of work together, both on the magazine and keeping their lands together.
The more we could look into our personal lives and share our childhoods with each other, the more all of us grew. And so the more we could share how to make cheese, you know, that seemed like the same kind of growth.
We explored things from a personal perspective, assuming that the more genuine we could be, the more the interest they would be to other women. And then we would have this really exciting time where we would all get together. There would be volunteer typists come down and type up all the articles that we decide, and then we would cut them out and do layout together. We had a whole stack of photographs that women had sent us and a whole stack of graphics that women had sent us, and we would go through the graphics and the photographs and stick them in with the articles.
The most important issue for me was the third issue we put out, well, Women as Artists. There weren't any women artists at the time, and so two of us, who had always drawn and kind of enjoyed drawing, never considered ourselves artists, came forward and said, okay, we'll lead this process, and went out and discovered women who had been always doing things, always making music, always dancing, and had never taken themselves seriously.
working on the sexuality issue was really an experience for me. We had a large collective, and we got very turned on reading all the articles that were coming in. We would stay late at night. Nobody would want to leave. One of the women wrote an introduction to that issue and said, we're 11 women working on this issue. This one is a lesbian. This one is straight. This one is bisexual. And everybody exploded and said, I am not. I'm a woman-identified woman. I'm not a lesbian. I'm just being with women. I'm not straight. I'm just, you know, like everybody identified themselves differently than what they were actually doing.
People started coming out. Life-changing experience. Within that second consciousness-raising group, oh, I'd say 10 women left their husbands or boyfriends and became lesbians, also all in a very small time period. And then there became a core group that not only worked together, but lived together and loved together, and the energy just exploded. It's very exciting, but it was also a mess because we didn't know what the limits were. I mean, in my own relationship, we were very much in love, but we were also in love with all these women, you know, and we thought that it could work that way. We thought that we could just share it, and of course we couldn't. But I guess it wasn't such a mess that we didn't keep the magazine going, and we had a weaving cooperative that was quite viable for a couple of years. And we were connected on so many levels as friends and as helpmates on projects on our land.
Oh, I'm walking this road. The ancestors are with me. It's a circling road. Oh, I'm walking this road. The ancestors are with me. It's a circling road. We return to the old ones as we came from the old ones. We return to the old ones as we came from the old ones. It's a circling road. It's a circling road.
There began to be published another magazine from Southern Oregon that became very important both to country women and to women involved in women's spirituality all over the world, actually, Woman Spirit magazine.
Beth Root lives in Southern Oregon at Flyaway Home, an isolated separatist women's land that was bought in 1976.
The Country Women magazine ceased publication, but Woman Spirit continued, and I think that magazine continuing to come out four times a year with a real clear focus on women's spirituality was sort of like a beacon that something special was happening here in the hills of Southern Oregon. Ruth and Jean Mountain Grove were the founders of Woman Spirit.
We stayed a month in Albion and helped put out the Country Women issue on spirituality. There were so many articles and poems submitted for that issue. I made the suggestion to Ruth that we start a magazine. This was one issue, and look at the interest in it. We should do a magazine on feminist spirituality. So we came back to Wolf Creek and announced we were going to do a feminist spirituality magazine. The first issue would be in the fall of 1974. We didn't really know how to define this magazine.
There was a very strong thing that you couldn't be a feminist and be spiritual, or that spirituality was a cop-out and feminism meant dealing with day-to-day problems.
We didn't know what spirituality was in a feminist world. We were making it up. We were exploring how to develop a women's culture. I don't think Off Our Backs or Women of Journal Liberation was talking about developing a women's culture. They were talking about destroying the patriarchy. And what would come next was not all that clear. Well, you know, it isn't clear, but at least I think having the space in the country where women were in control of the land gave us a sense of what it's like to be in control of your life and to be in control of the influences and how you live your life, which is, of course, building a culture.
Spirituality is really about daily life and how we live it.
Musawa bought the first piece of women's land in Northern Oregon in 1973, Women's Healing Ground.
I mean, I know this is what happened for me, and it happened on my generation of women who moved to the land, that that's where we became open to spirituality, was by living on the earth. I mean, it was the last thing we sort of had on our agendas for moving to the land. It's just that when you spend some time in silence, there you are with yourself. Being in the presence of the spirit, that form of spirituality which takes us to our deepest place, that's the kind of spirituality that living on the land has opened us to.
By By the mid-70s, women were flocking to Southern Oregon wanting to live on land, but many of them did not have enough money to buy their own property. The women who were already living on land could not accommodate all these new women, like Space and her lover Guthrie.
I wanted a piece of land that I could put my energy into and know that even if I left, what I did would still be there for women.
The women who did not have money to buy land felt very angry that they did not have this privilege. And that didn't seem fair, that through, you know, how your father got his money depended on whether you could have this privilege of having land. And that's why the cry for open women's land came about, where you didn't have to get along with the landowner in order to be there, just you could live with Mother Nature.
Guthrie and I had the idea of the land trust. We were doing all this research into land trust. I worked in the civil rights movement in Mississippi in 64, and there was a land trust started to help tenant farmers get their own land in Mississippi, so I had been in touch with that. Started talking concretely about it in a group out of a workshop that was held at Women's Share on class and money.
And so the idea was to create a land that would be for all women, it would be held in trust by all women. We made up the legal precedent of a women's land trust.
So it became a community project. We started by contributing 10% of our savings to a fund for the down payment.
By this time I was involved with Fan Chan, who lived in Albion, and she and Estrella and their little girls came to visit us. It was sort of funny because we'd go to Cottage Grove to the real estate person and to ask about these huge pieces of land, and then I'd go to the food stamp office, my food stamp. And we were living on next to no money. Anyway, one time they stopped in Canyonville to do their laundry, and in the Canyonville health food store with this little notice of this land.
We wandered into the health food store, and these gay men in the health food store said, "Oh, well, there's some land down the road." We went and looked at it, and we looked at each other, and we said, "It's nice land, but it's not right for us." And we called the Oregon Women's Land Trust, and we said, "We just saw some land that's actually okay." And they went and followed it up, and that would turn out to be our farm.
It was 147 acres east of Canyonville, 10 or 15 miles. The last 3 miles is up a dirt road. It's the whole top of the mountain. I really liked it because of the open meadows. There are a lot of cedar trees and huge madrone trees. There's a big log house and a log barn that pretty much had fallen down, and a smaller chicken coop. The whole 147 acres cost $65,000.
An Oregon Women's Land Trust meeting on our farmland for the first time. Up until this time, it had just been a land trust that had been meeting in different places, but now they had their own land to have their first meeting on. And it was like 200 women, and it was an incredible celebration.
I think there was just a huge sense of, wow, we did it. That there were so many people that were excited for us, and that it was such a beautiful land. I don't even remember. I know we just probably went dancing all over the land and probably did Tai Chi and karate and sang all night. There were all these women that wanted to live there, and people brought things, goats and chickens, and people came that knew things.
Well, the original intention was that this would be a sanctuary for the safety of women in patriarchy, and therefore any woman could come there to be safe.
We wanted to be open to everybody, but we ended up limiting the main caretaking collective, we called ourselves, to 35. The main house basically was one big room, part of which was a kitchen. And we always ate dinner together. We had a communal dinner, and we would hold hands and sing and then eat and almost always play music afterwards. There were a lot of really good musicians with guitars and fiddles, and we had a piano. We shared all our money. Everybody who got a check just put it in.
Well, that was 1976, and women arrived in need of great healing. And there were no rules. There was no one who owned the land who could say this is what goes and this is who goes and what doesn't happen here.
We were being like a battered women's shelter in the country. We wanted to do this, but we didn't have anything like private space. not even physical space. We were not private. We had feelings meetings every week. We had political meetings. We talked about racism every week. We talked about working class Jewish women, mothers, singles. All these things came out of Al Farm, and women would come up from the city and they'd say, "You can't fence the goats in because it reminds me of when I was in prison." And that's classist if you fence the goats in. We had all the expectations of the entire West Coast women's movement focused on that piece of land. When I left, I went and lived on an island by myself in British Columbia.
It was the summer of 76. And that very summer was the summer that Mama Mountain was just getting started. I was farther south in Covelo, California, where we had a whole mountainside that we were thinking of trying to buy.
Estrella was one of the Aurora women, a group of 13 women who were looking for land.
Several women that were part of Aurora had little stashes of money, and some of us at Aurora, like myself, had no money. But we had done so much processing together about sharing and everything that these women were actually willing to put their money more or less in the center so that we could all buy land together.
We had, from this one woman, $37,000, which in that day and age was actually quite a lot of money. And we figured that if we needed more, somehow it would come to us. We decided that if we found land that was the right size for the 13 or 14 of us, that's what we would do. But if we found land that was large enough for a village, then that's what we would do.
And then we went to a place that was actually 1,500 acres in the Oli Boli Wilderness area. And we saw that place, which we couldn't buy with our money.
This realtor had bought this large piece of land and divided it into, I don't know, six or eight parcels. And the first crew went out to look at one of these parcels and came back and said, "It's beautiful land. We want all of it."
We were so excited about the idea of having a women's village. And so instead of getting land for just our group, we were going to go and buy this whole 2 square miles and invite all kinds of women to come, and we would have a women's village, and we would live all over this land in scattered little pieces. Some women would live as couples, some as singles, some as communities, however women wanted to live, and we were all going to be in this one place.
They wanted, I don't know, $250,000 for it. Per acre, it was really cheap. The Eel River ran through the bottom of it, and the top of it was a mountain 4,000 feet high. When we told the realtor that we had to experience it to know whether we wanted to buy it, and we were going to camp on it, we told them, for a week.
We convinced them that we had so much money, which wasn't really true, but we acted like we had more money than we had, and we had shaved heads, and we looked really weird, and we were really wild, but we somehow convinced them that we were very eccentric, rich women. So they decided to let us camp out there.
And what we did was we moved our entire operation, which was gigantic, there. And at the same time, we let all of our connections know that we were doing this. And they all showed up there also.
One day I was there and I went over to another little meadow not far from where I was camping to sit there and write a couple of letters. And this coyote walked right into my lap, practically.
I went through a spiritual awakening there in some ways. I spent 7 days and seven nights up at the top of the mountain by myself. I suddenly saw that I lived now under that tree there. I lived under that tree. I had no other home. I'd given everything away, basically, and moved into this world where I was trying to find this place on the earth to live.
There were numbers of women that came and camped there that summer, and there were four camps, one at the top, one a little farther down, one a little farther down, one at the bottom on the river.
And we fought all summer about whether or not to buy this land or how to buy it.
So the arguments were over what kinds of things people wanted to do on the land, and it turned out that we all had very different ideas of how to move on the land. Some women did not want to build even a road that would involve a bulldozer, but that would keep everything at a very primitive level so that no real food could be grown. But the ones who were being most pure about what we shouldn't touch on the land were also being the most unrealistic about what was needed to survive there. And the others who really wanted, I mean, my bias is coming through here, but it seemed like the ones who really were in touch with wanting to make a way of life there were trying to think of what do we need to build and to have gardens and to grow our own food and to be here through the winter and that kind of thing.
And we definitely had different ideas about how we should do this, if we should do this, when we should do this, how we were going to get the money to do this.
who we were going to do it with, who was going to be invited to the land, what were the rules on the land going to be. We had all kinds of issues that we were discussing in a very intense manner all summer long, at the same time everybody sleeping with everybody and freaking out.
They had been doing these guided visualizations, and they had weekly feelings meetings, and they had developed other ways of working through things and being spiritual, but at the same time there were contagious diseases, staph and scabies, and there was a lot of indecision about what to do.
There were a lot of control issues about who was going to be in control and how. A lot of women who didn't have money didn't want the women who had the money to be the ones who controlled things. The women with money didn't want to put their money in unless they had a certain amount of control, some of them, and some of them were totally into giving up their control, and they fought with each other about that.
We were negotiating with the realtors all the time, and they would go in and hold these meetings and talk circles around these realtors that didn't know what to do.
Before we bought the land, people wanted to somehow hash all this stuff out instead of just buying the land and hashing it out.
There was no water supply. It was not really arable land. It was quite dry. You know, we'd have to figure out some way to irrigate from the river, which was at the bottom of the land. There was no electricity anywhere near the land.
I didn't think that there was enough water on the land to do the thing we were envisioning. So I was more or less against buying the place, even though I was madly, madly in love with it. I just thought it was the most beautiful, beautiful, total place.
I felt at the time we weren't ready for what we were doing. We hadn't built the skills and the means to accomplish our vision. Kind of felt like, to me, a setup for failure, trying to do everything on such a large scale that it was all beyond us.
We decided that the way we would choose whether we were going to buy Mama Mountain or not was all the women involved with Mama Mountain got together in a circle, and we were going to flip a peyote button, and which way it fell was whether, yes or no, whether we were going to buy the land. And we did this ritual and did all this magic and hummed and sang, and then we threw the button up in the air, and it came down, yes, we were supposed to buy the land.